Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Gaffney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to the glory of God and his kingdom. We have been tracking closely the developments that have befallen Israel since it was attacked without warning on a holy day for the Jewish people, Saturday, as well as in the intervening period. Often with the help of our friend and colleague, who is, I'm pleased to say, forward deployed at the moment in Tel Aviv. His name is Dr. David Wormser. He is an extraordinary and very highly regarded expert on Middle East matters, has served in very senior roles in the U.S. government with regard to his specialty. Prior to all of that, he was a naval intelligence officer, rose through the ranks, in fact, to that of lieutenant commander. These days, I'm proud to say he is in charge of our Middle East program at the Center for Security Policy, and we're very pleased to have a chance to catch up with him again. David, thank you. I'm glad you are well, and wanted to get from you kind of an update. We had a full hour with you on Saturday as you were under fire, as I recall, in Tel Aviv. But tell us how things look at the moment.
Well, here in Tel Aviv, for the moment, it's quiet. So we're not getting hit by any rocket or missile volleys. But in the south, just about 10, 15 miles south of here, there's now, they're saying, almost a continuous missile fire and rocket fire coming in from Gaza, as well as Israeli strikes back into Gaza. We don't have yet any indication of a ground invasion, although I'm fairly certain that's coming at some point in the near future, very near future. Now, the north, the second front, is in effect now already a front. And that involves two borders, Syria and Lebanon, and both are hot right now. Hot meaning not just tense, there's gunfire. So this morning we've had dozens of rockets shot into Israel from Lebanon, anti-tank rounds, Coronet anti-tank missiles shot at Israelis, mortar fire. And the Israelis have responded with some airstrikes, a few artillery rounds, and so forth. Now, on the Syrian border as well, there were some rockets shot, about a dozen rockets shot into the Golan Heights from Syria, as well as the Israelis are monitoring very closely the Radwan forces of Hezbollah that are on right, that have deployed now right up to the border. They are the forces that have trained the Hamas terrorists that crossed into Israel. So this is the father of these units that do the rapid crossing with motorcycles to massacre. So you can only imagine how the Israelis relate to that. And there's some indications that they have taken up one outpost within the demilitarized zone. There's a no man's land between Israel and Syria, and they are in there, and they have taken up a post. So I think that, you know, with gunfire and so forth, oh, and there's constant gunfire going across the border at this point as well. So it is
in the Golan or in Lebanon, or both?
Both. So this is now a hot front as well.
And what is the role of Iran in all of this? They've, of course, been operating in Lebanon through Hezbollah as well as, I guess, in their own right to some extent. But certainly they've been very much present on the ground in Syria. Mm-hmm. Is there any indication that they're directly engaging as well?
We unfortunately do have some indications. First of all, this war is ordered and bought and paid for and prepared for and armed by Iran. This war is coming from Tehran. This is not coming locally. So we have to keep that in mind. Now, as far as Gaza goes, there are now three videos that show, or two videos that seem to appear, it's hard, they're garbled, of some of these atrocity videos you're hearing in the background, Farsi, in some of them, which means that there were probably IRGC officers involved. So there's a third eyewitness.
That would be the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, IRGC.
Yeah, which are Iran.
Of Iran.
There's a third video of a survivor who she says the way that the terrorists were organized was there were Arabs who were chattering and not very disciplined. But then there was a core of two or three people who just did not speak and were highly disciplined, highly trained, that ran the operation, and she was convinced they were Iranian.
I'm sorry, where was that, David?
Where these atrocities were conducted on the Gaza border.
Coming out of Gaza into Israel during this invasion.
So there's some indications of direct involvement. I have a friend who's following payments, and there will be stuff forthcoming from him, payments that were made to Hamas from Iran in the weeks before. And then finally, the Iranian opposition has uncovered some documents or some communications between Tehran and Hamas at the highest levels, where Hamas was reporting to Tehran that the two underground facilities are complete and they're ready now to go. And that was 10 days ago. So just on the eve of the war. So clearly an operational check-in from Gaza to Iran, saying we're good to go now.
David, of course, a persistent source of debate and consternation is how this invasion from Gaza was launched, seemingly based on extensive preparations, but undetected by either Israeli intelligence, which is formidable, as you know, or our own. What do you make of that?
Well, let me start with Israeli intelligence. There will be commissions of inquiry. There will be an investigation. This was a catastrophic failure. There's no question. You can look at it from a tactical point of view, the taking out up front of monitoring equipment. That certainly was a factor. But I think what we're hearing more and more was there was a massive cyber attack that took down all communications in the South. And that, of course, was operationally devastating for the Israelis because that meant forces couldn't react or operate accordingly. And
they lacked sort of situational awareness.
Complete situational blindness. Yeah, there was complete blindness. So there's that. But then, of course, the larger question, and it's not an excuse, but you're talking about a very populated area and then motorcycle forces racing toward the border. Where the failure was is that Hamas had been, for the last weeks, essentially doing little dry runs. And on one side, that led Israel to be overly complacent. On the other side, it led Israel to believe that what Hamas might be planning is, you know, one or two small incursions, terrorist attacks like we're used to, and not something like this. And then a lot just comes out of the populated areas. But this is a failure. On the American side, I don't know. Our intelligence, first of all, probably is not operationally on the ground in Gaza very effective. I mean, I'm sure the Israelis have better intelligence. But I really do think we have to ask ourselves whether or not on the analytical level, whether in the DIA's analytical divisions, the CIA's analytical divisions, whether or not there's a clarity of purpose, people who understand who the good guys are and who the bad guys are and interpret the information accordingly.
Yeah. David, we have to take a short break. When we come back, I want to visit with you about one other possible contributing factor, and that is, as I heard you talking about with our colleague Carolyn Glick on a wonderful podcast that you did together, I think on Sunday, whether there are individuals inside our government who may be contributing to a lack of clarity, shall we say, and a lack of focus. And we'll get to that with David Wormser, the Center for Security Policy, right after this. Stay tuned. We'll be right back. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Yesterday, Joe Biden reiterated American solidarity with Israel and sought to deter Iran, another of its terrorist proxies, Hezbollah, and others from interfering with Israel's retaliation for Saturday's murderous invasion by Hamas. Unfortunately, Biden's credibility is sorely lacking, as his administration had actively contributed to conditions that prompted that horrific attack. It relentlessly conveyed hostility towards the Israeli government, was complicit in leftist congressional efforts to deny the Jewish state resupplies of vital anti-missile weaponry, undermined Israel's existing peace agreements with regional regimes, and interfered with the conclusion of one with Saudi Arabia. Worse yet, it resumed taxpayer funding of Hamas and other Palestinian terrorists, allowed over $30 billion to flow to Iran, and turned a blind eye to Chinese destabilizing of the region. To truly stand with Israel, Joe Biden must stop standing with her enemies and ours. This is Frank Affney. Welcome back. Our guest is Dr. David Wormser, one of our top experts on the Middle East, I say nationally, if not internationally. Certainly, we take great pride in his association with our Center for Security Policy, where he directs our Mideast program. David has worked for an Undersecretary of State, a National Security Advisor, the Vice President of the United States in previous incarnations, as well as served as a naval intelligence officer. And I want to come back to the intelligence point that we were talking about, or maybe counterintelligence point, David. When we mull why it is that the United States' massive intelligence capabilities did not detect evidence of what was going on here, or at least act on it, there is a question that is insidious in the extreme, and I wanted to ask you about it. I heard you talking with our colleague Carolyn Glick, our senior fellow and a great contributor to this program, about it in a recent podcast. A fellow by the name of Mahir Bitar and his role on the National Security Council, and whether that might have had any impact in all of this, and if so, whether he's alone.
Well, I'm sure that had an impact, and I think
tell us about him and what
question.
He plays.
Sure. So Mahir Bitar is Senior Director for Intelligence at the National Security Council. This is the position that coordinates all the intelligence flowing into the White House from the various agencies, as well as coordinates the intelligence that the president, the vice president, the NSC actually relates to. He's essentially the definer of reality, intelligence reality for the president, if you know, it is perhaps a good way to put it. Now,
Mahir Bitar, filter, in other words.
He's a filter. He's a filter, and he's an editor, and he's a choreographer, orchestrator of information to the top levels of the White House. And also back down the signaling sent to the intelligence community of what they want and what tasking and how they should look at things and the policies, priorities, and all that sort of stuff.
And so what's his background?
His background is he is a Palestinian who worked with the United Nations Relief Works Agency, which was the agency that built the schools and the hospitals and basically funded the infrastructure that Hamas used to hide behind as a shield for terrorism. Now, this is a man who, and by the way, we all saw it. It was not anything hidden that Hamas was using schools for missile launching positions and arsenals and hospitals for command centers and missile launching pads and arsenal storage as well.
So human shields, in other words.
Everybody saw it. So the question is, did this guy not see the obvious, which should be a damning indictment of an intelligence official, or did he see it and sympathized, which is a damning indictment of an intelligence official who works for America and its allies? Either one, this is not good. And I'm sure that his overall view, which he went to Georgetown University, was a member of BDS, the Boycott, Divest, Sanction movement that wants Israel destroyed, etc. He was a member of that. I'm sure that this ideological intensity has clouded his actions and his activity in servicing the president in the United States of America.
Well, and sadly, he's not alone in having those proclivities, unfortunately. In fact, I think it's fair to say, David, among other things, that when the president was campaigning for office, he essentially committed himself to pulling in lots of Muslims for positions throughout his government. And the people he was talking to, and I think the people thereby he recruited for those roles, were Muslim Brotherhood affiliated individuals.
Absolutely. Look no further than their anti-Semitism policy, which was unveiled and rolled out with great fanfare. They included in the steering committee of this anti-Semitism task force the American Muslim Council and CARE, which now has come out supporting Hamas doing these horrific atrocities and massacring Jews in ways
two
that
prominent Muslim Brotherhood fronts in the United States. Yeah. What would you expect?
But right. There are now, basically, we know now of influence peddling operations run by the Iranian government that were staffed out at State Department by Robert Malley, including now at the Pentagon, the person who's responsible, the civilian, the top civilian in charge of special operations for the U.S., is this lady, Ariane Tabata Bai, who is an Iranian, who is basically, we now know from her email, she was essentially working for the Iranians. And she's still there, still in charge of special operations.
Unbelievable, David. As a former Pentagon official, and you obviously worked in the Pentagon a lot yourself, this is not just a counterintelligence disaster, it seems to me, but it bespeaks an indifference to that unfortunately is really a leitmotif of this administration.
Well, more than an indifference, they agree with the ideological premise that these agents of influence from abroad are peddling. And therefore, you really see the sympathy with Iran, the sympathy with the Palestinians. So the policymakers enjoy having they are their implementers.
Right. You know, David, I did a commentary today on this whole issue. The president was in the White House yesterday, standing with Israel. We're told as we speak that he's going to be making another speech about Israel today. My guess is it may be introducing the idea of cautionary notes to Israel. Don't be too aggressive. Don't be too violent. But whatever he's going to say, it will be more of, I think, evidence that this administration's inclinations and proclivities and priorities have long been with Israel's enemies, not Israel's friends. And I've called on them to, if you're going to stand with Israel, stop standing with her enemies and ours, notably, of course, Iran and China. And we don't have time to talk about China, David, at the moment, but I did just want to say, as you look at what is about to unfold, assuming there will be a ground assault on Gaza by Israeli armor and other forces, what should we know about that? And what should we in the United States be doing and saying about it?
Sure. First of all, what we should know is that Israel cannot allow a status quo ante with greater Israeli power to emerge. This is over. The conceptions, the massive panoply of conceptions that have governed the whole two-state solution, the whole structure of introducing the cobra into your bed, whether it was the PLO in the West Bank or Hamas, is over. Israel can't, or Hezbollah on the northern border. So I think there's a fundamental sea change that will obtain in Israel following this.
But when you say it's over, does that mean that that's been now rejected by the Israeli population as well as its leadership?
Yes, it's in the process of being rejected. But such fundamental outlooks take a transition period. But it's happening, and I see it. I see it with left-wing people saying it and so forth. That's one thing.
Including about Hezbollah, I understand. Is that right?
Yes, absolutely. And then the second thing is Israel suffered a major defeat for Israel to continue to live in this region and be viable as a country, it must show itself to be the strong horse. It cannot make peace if countries believe it is an albatross or a weak, limping, wounded animal or anything like that. Israel has to emerge strong as can be. And a traumatic victory has to be administered on Israel's enemies. A traumatic, which I believe has to lead to Tehran. It started in Gaza. It should end in Tehran. Now, that should be an Israeli victory. The more the United States actively helps, the less Israel can claim that it's strong. So as painful as it is, the Israelis have to go this alone.
Yeah, and my concern would be, frankly, if we start helping, we will, in fact, wind up hindering. So all the more reason why Israel must do the job here. David Wormser, thank you for your insights. Thank you for being in Israel at this critical time. Stay safe, my friend. Come back to us with updates soon, if you would. We'll be right back with more with the great Grant Newsom right after this.
Night after night, in cities across the country, black-garbed assailants clash with police in the streets, smash windows, and throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
We're back, and I'm pleased to say, always when I have the chance to do so, that Colonel Grant Newsom, United States Marine Corps retired, is in the house virtually. He is one of our great authorities on duty experts concerning the Chinese Communist Party, both the military threat that it represents to us and to freedom more generally, as well as the various other lines of attack that the Chinese communists have been using for decades in what they call unrestricted warfare against America. Grant Newsom is not only a very distinguished military veteran, he is also a former Foreign Service officer, as well as a quite successful businessman in the Western Pacific. Grant, it's great to have you as one of our senior fellows at the Center for Security Policy, as well as one of our regular guests here. Welcome back, sir.
I'm glad to be here. Thanks very much.
Gosh, I've got so much I want to talk to you about. I'd like to pick up on some of the issues that we were addressing with David Wormser, our colleague at the center, in the previous segments. Grant, get your perspective on it. We were unable to develop with David the involvement of the Chinese Communist Party in the attacks against Israel that were mounted notably on Saturday, but in the days since as well from Hamas. But now also another Iranian proxy, Hezbollah, is in active, fire exchanges with Israel from Lebanon, and apparently other elements working presumably with and for the Iranians as well in Syria. There's a report out of a blogger that has been fairly accurate in the past, I think, in a number of news stories, Luda News, I believe it's called, that there's actually been in the public domain evidence that the Chinese were meeting with both the Iranians and the Palestinians, including Hamas representatives, in the months leading up to this invasion. Would that surprise you if it's so? And how does that fit into the Chinese game in the Middle East specifically at the moment?
Well, it doesn't surprise me at all, and I suspect the information is probably is accurate. The Chinese connections and dealings with Iran are very well known, widely reported. I think they have something like plans for about $400 billion worth of investments in Iran. This is well known. And Iran, of course, is the linchpin for so much of the terrorism in the Middle East and in the world, in fact. And it has been for our lifetimes. So this doesn't surprise me at all, and very much is in line with China's MO to support these kind of groups. And this goes back actually to the 60s and the 70s, support for African so-called liberation movements. Like Robert Mugabe, for example, was China's guy, received tons of aid from them. Robert Mugabe of Zimbabwe, I guess not everyone remembers that. But say this is nothing new. They provide support to terrorist groups all around the world, in Asia, Middle East, you name it. So this shouldn't surprise anyone.
And the support that they're providing is also of a very material kind in terms of buying up, it seems, most of, if not actually all of, the output of Iran's considerable oil production and export capacity. I understand that it's in recent years risen to something like 3 million barrels a day from less than 500,000 under Donald Trump's sanctions. That's a lot of cash available by some estimates, 30 to 40 billion in the past year alone. I've heard numbers as high as 140 billion over the previous years as well. You can buy a lot of terrorism and more generally jihad for that kind of money, can't you, Colonel?
Oh, that's right. Yeah, terrorism comes cheap, and the Chinese will buy any amount of oil that the Iranians can pump. They'll buy it all. And it is that financial support which also which gives the Iranians the wherewithal to support the terrorists. And also, there's an angle of political support there. The Iranians effectively know that China has their back. And ultimately, as a result, there's real limits to what the Americans can do, or what if the Americans do things, that China will sort of make up the difference, or will make sure that Iran doesn't get hit too hard on this. And that is a huge advantage to have, and it gives Iran the confidence to go after what it's trying to do in to destabilize the Middle East. And it, as I say, it is a very effective approach the Chinese have taken. You see how the Americans, how the State Department has avoided talking about this, saying there's no direct evidence. Well, what is our $80 billion in intelligence work every year getting us? I say this is pretty obvious, and China likes what is going on in the Middle East.
Colonel, I'd like to get your thoughts on this. You've spent a lot of time working with U.S. intelligence over the years, both in your military days as well as in your foreign service ones. We were talking with David Wormser a bit about a possible factor in why the U.S. can't seem to see any connection between Iran and what's happened in Israel, to say nothing of Chinese involvement in it all. And that is that perhaps at least a contributing factor is a woman who is the chief of staff to the Assistant Secretary of Defense for Special Operations is somebody believed to have been placed as an Iranian agent of influence in that key position, and prior to that, actually into a similar key position in the State Department, by Robert Malley on behalf of his ongoing and very problematic dalliance with Iran. From a counterintelligence point of view, sir, this would seem to be yet another indication of malfeasance at the very best, if not treason. Your thoughts?
It's pretty darn close to the latter. There's a point at which the malfeasance of this administration gets beyond, you know, just being incompetent and to actually having nefarious and malicious intentions towards the United States. It's absolutely outrageous, assuming these reports are true, and nobody has denied them about this person who has gotten into that job as the chief of staff.
And is still in the job, apparently,
You really wonder if we're trying to lose. That's how bad this is. As for Malley, who had his security clearances stripped, the listeners should have some idea of just how hard it is to have that happen. And they will only do it, especially in this sort of administration, when the evidence is overwhelming. So the Iranians effectively have had their guys in the Biden administration running Iran policy. What could possibly go wrong with that? That's how bad it is. I suppose the adults are back in charge as they were crowing when they took office a couple of years ago.
You know, Colonel, this is such a critical point, and you've, as usual, articulated it in a very concise and powerful way. It's as though we want to lose. That can't be said of the Chinese Communist Party, as far as I can tell. And I wondered if you would connect the dots for us. We're going to have to take a short break here in a moment, but maybe just a quick introductory observation about how, as you said, the MO of China, the modus operandi, the, you know, business practice of China is to engender conflict or otherwise destabilize situations in one place to their benefit elsewhere. Actually, I'm just going to ask you to hold that thought, Grant. We just don't have time for you to respond at this point. Sure. We'll do so on the other side of this short break. We're visiting with the author most recently of When China Attacks, a powerful new book by Colonel Grant Newsom, United States Marine Corps retired. You're going to want to find out what China is actually up to here and what it'll mean for us on the other side of this break. Stay tuned. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Yesterday, Joe Biden reiterated American solidarity with Israel and sought to deter Iran, another of its terrorist proxies, Hezbollah, and others from interfering with Israel's retaliation for Saturday's murderous invasion by Hamas. Unfortunately, Biden's credibility is sorely lacking, as his administration had actively contributed to conditions that prompted that horrific attack. It relentlessly conveyed hostility towards the Israeli government, was complicit in leftist congressional efforts to deny the Jewish state resupplies of vital anti-missile weaponry, undermined Israel's existing peace agreements with regional regimes, and interfered with the conclusion of one with Saudi Arabia. Worse yet, it resumed taxpayer funding of Hamas and other Palestinian terrorists, allowed over $30 billion to flow to Iran, and turned a blind eye to Chinese destabilizing of the region. To truly stand with Israel, Joe Biden must stop standing with her enemies and ours. This is Frank Affney. We're back, and I'm very pleased to say we are joined by one of our other favorite regulars. His name is Bill Walton. He is these days the proprietor of and the host and driving force behind a marvelous television podcast. It is called The Bill Walton Show. But he brings to it a wealth of experience that makes it not only very, very compelling television and a great source of information, but also I think required viewing. And Bill's experience includes that of, as I'm fond of saying, a recovering master of the universe on Wall Street, where he ran a $6 billion company called Allied Capital. He has also been the president of the Council for National Policy, a preeminent organization which I'm proud to be a member, representing conservative interests and values and priorities. And Bill, you are, for all these reasons, a great guy to visit with about this civilizational conflict that is upon us. It seems now, clearly, as we talked about with Sam Faddis a moment ago, a real clash of good and evil. And when one talks about good, we're not saying that anyone is perfect. We're certainly not. But it couldn't be more clear, could it, as to which side we want to be on in this particular clash?
Well, the thing to realize, to remember about Israel, is that Israel started out with on a strip of sand in 1949 as an independent state. And since then, Israel has become not only the most important, maybe the only liberal democracy in that part of the world, bastion of our part of our Judeo-Christian values, but also Israel now is the innovation and entrepreneurship that the country's shown, and the individuals have now, those of us in the venture community, call it startup nation, and it's just 50% of its exports are tech exports. And so we talk about clash of civilizations. On the one hand, you look at what Israel has done, starting with nothing, and then you turn your attention to the Gaza Strip, which has been controlled by Hamas, I think, what, since 2005, and it's the most densely populated piece of dirt on Earth with 2 million people in it. And they've done absolutely nothing with it to create a strong economy or a vibrant society. Of the 2 million people, the average age is about 25 years old, so it's one of the youngest countries on the planet. And of those young people, roughly 75% are unemployed. So they've done nothing to create opportunities for young people and growth in the society. So in terms of the clash of civilizations, it's clear where we need to stand on this. They've had plenty of opportunities, almost 20 years, to build something in Gaza. It hasn't happened.
So I can just hear people responding, Bill, by saying, well, this is entirely Israel's fault. It was surrounded and essentially cut off from the world and terribly oppressed.
As I recollect, Frank, Israel in 1949 was surrounded and cut off from the world. And
big time. With people actually set on destroying it. Yeah, but Bill, let me just ask you, the argument that we kicked around a little bit with Sam Faddis is that this is a lot less about the dissatisfaction and frustrations and anger of Palestinians in Gaza than it is about an agenda on the part of jihadists, whether they're in Tehran or whether they're in the Gaza Strip or any place else for that matter, to pursue the destruction of, well, the Judeo-Christian civilization, as you sort of described it a moment ago, with Israel as the part of it that's closest at hand. And they've demonstrated both their intent and I think what is clearly the agenda of the Iranian mullahs now, whether they do it directly themselves and with nuclear weapons, perhaps, or whether they do it through these kinds of proxies like Hamas and maybe Hezbollah next. Your thoughts?
Well, we know that Hamas is a proxy for Iran, and increasingly Iran is a proxy for China. And they've had lots of dealings extensively in the last decade, and it's growing. And so, yeah, certainly this is not just about some unemployed kids in Gaza that are acting up. This is part of a global strategy to eradicate the Judeo-Christian civilization, and in particular Israel, as a place to start. And the thing we need to be mindful of is that, and you mentioned my background in finance. The Biden administration is also aiding and abetting this in the most egregious way. This $6 billion, which they say didn't go to this, it was allocated for humanitarian purposes. Well, really, come on. I mean, anybody, if you've got a money market account and a checking account, your the money in the bank has gone up a lot, and you can use one for the other with no problem. And that's exactly what Iran's done here.
And fungibility, as they say.
Excuse me?
Fungibility.
Fungibility, yes. Right. And so we're, and then we've got the Biden administration courting reestablishing strong relations with Iran. And of course, Iran has their nuclear program, and the only other nuclear program in the area is Israel. So there's all this at stake. And, you hear reporting here in the U.S. where I think anybody who starts saying that uses the term both sides, it's really a dog whistle. It means we support Hamas and we're against Israel. And so this both sides, which we seem to be getting from every major media outlet, is again something that's extremely disheartening. And I think, as Sam pointed out, Sam Faddis pointed out in your earlier segment, China is very much in the mix here.
Yeah, we have to take a short break, Bill, and I want to come to that next. But just on this larger point, this idea of moral equivalence between the good and the evil is reprehensible in the extreme, and it's going to get people killed, not just in Israel, I'm afraid, but here as well. We'll be right back with more with Bill Walton. Stay tuned. Welcome back. We're taking stock of the situation most immediately of this war that is now broken out in the Middle East, following on the war that has broken out in Eastern Europe. And quite possibly a prelude to war breaking out in the Western Pacific and maybe beyond. And Bill, we were just at the point of introducing another player in all of this. We've got Hamas, of course, we've got Hezbollah, we've got the Iranian regime that runs both, and certainly was implicated deeply in this invasion of Israel. But behind them all, there's China, which has now developed a close relationship with the mullahs in Tehran, and seems to be set on not just encouraging these fronts, but quite possibly opening up still more, including through the use of its own military forces in the Western Pacific. Talk a little bit about your assessment of China's role in all of this.
Well, as China looks at the global chessboard, they have to be delighted with what's happened in Israel and the Gaza Strip. The image I have is of one of our aircraft carriers steaming through the Mediterranean to come to the aid of Israel, or at least to stand offshore. And the way Xi would look at that, President Xi of China, would be, well, that's one less aircraft carrier we would need to deal with in the South China Sea if they do have intentions on Taiwan. And the other thing is that we've seen with the $150 billion of money we shipped to Ukraine, which was turned into weapons in some cases, but it looks like some of those weapons have made their way back through the black market to Gaza and helped finance, if not provided the weapons for the attack on Israel. They're watching all these developments and seeing that our ability to pay attention to Taiwan grows less and less. And the calculation, though, is, you know, as we've talked about before, the Chinese economy is on the ropes. The real estate sector has collapsed, residential real estate in particular, and their exports are down. They're actually charted to grow 3-5% a year. And what do totalitarian leaders do when things are tough at home and people are grumbling? Well, they tend to find a war to fight. And what better target would there be than Taiwan?
Yeah. Bill, on that point, you know, you mentioned the demographic situation in Gaza, a country that's got a median age that is now sizably comprised of military-aged men for whom there's no work, or women. Is another impetus, it seems, for lashing out, finding ways to employ them as cannon fodder rather than have them festering at home. Right. So all of that suggests that we may well be, you know, watching a ratcheting up that will result in attacks. I mentioned with Sam Faddis in the earlier block the possibility that it begins with yet another distracting a conflict on the Korean Peninsula. It's entirely possible that we could see Pakistan induced to engage with India at the same time, or perhaps even in our own so-called backyard. I think it was really our front yard. The Chinese presence in Latin America is the stuff of which a lot of mischief can be made. So when you look at this, you mentioned chess. I called it a game of Go, which is the Chinese preferred and arguably even more challenging multi-level, multi-layer game of strategy. These all seem to be aligning in a direction that is going to make the conflict Xi is clearly preparing for inevitable.
Well, since Biden's come in and brought in all his able lieutenants like Anthony Blinken, who has just proven himself increasingly to be, each day he seems more and more naive and much more filled, you know, much more overtly lying about things than he even did even 6 months ago.
I detect a scintilla of cynicism in that comment about his brilliant lieutenant.
It's that Wall Street. That Wall Street part.
Yeah, there you go again.
I'm not buying his act. Anyway, so you mentioned all these places, and I'm sure it was an oversight. You forgot to mention our own border, and you also mentioned all those young people in Gaza, and some of those people, I think, have found their way to the U.S. as part of the influx of immigrants from all over the world, including China. And you have to believe that Hamas has been working that channel effectively. And I think the thing we really need to worry about now is how much of that has come into the United States and how much of that is orchestrated in part by China. I think we've seen that the Islamic fascist and the Chinese can make common cause quite easily. So we're
even though it just has to be said, even though the Chinese are genocidally repressing a Muslim population as we speak, I mean, it's evidence of the cynicism of this idea of the Ummah, the great, unified Muslim world. Not so much.
Did you hear that profuse declaration of disgust from the China about the terrorism in Israel? They were silent. And, you know, as we know, they're one of the largest perpetrators of internal terrorism on their own people. So
they sure are. We talk about that at some length, as you know. I can't resist the temptation to point it out in our book, The Indictment, the first charge of which, Bill, is the crimes against humanity in which the Chinese Communist Party is engaged against principally its own people. And the point that I think is just urgently needed here is that any country that treats its own folks that way is not going to treat ours any better. Bill, we are out of time, alas. It flies by when we're having fun.
We need to talk about moral relevancy next time, Frank.
Relativism, I think you mean.
Yes. Because we're dealing with that here in the United States, and our inability to condemn Hamas is...
We have to let you go, Bill. Thank you so much for joining us. We'll get into much more on our next visit. In the meantime, God bless you. God bless all of you. I hope that you will join us next time. Until then, that you will go forth and multiply.